Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, City of Arcata coordinates the clearing of two-decade-old homeless encampment, and an interview with the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML, about government's categorical gun ban for cannabis consumers. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
The City of Arcata coordinated the clearing of a two-decade-old homeless encampment, managing billing, directing a cleanup contractor, and continuing trespass enforcement across four properties, while the people being displaced were faced with navigating a local shelter system already at capacity, or simply relocating to a different greenbelt or open lot nearby. Redheaded Black Belt reporter Ryan Hudson has the story.
Beginning in early summer of 2025, with the support of the Great Redwood Trail Agency, the City of Arcata initiated a sustained multi-property clearing operation. Months of escalating pressure on unhoused campers to leave followed, destination unknown. Along a stretch of railroad corridor on the south end of Arcata, dozens of people called a sprawling, overgrown, homeless encampment their home. Some had been there for 5 years, some for 10. They called it the 40, while the city called it a public health concern. But for a long time, the go-to encampment was, in the words of one resident, out of sight, out of mind. Over the past 9 months, the City of Arcata has orchestrated a sustained push to clear the corridor. One that spans four separate properties, involves a private contractor for cleanup, raises unresolved questions about disability rights, and has displaced an estimated 40 people with nowhere to go. At its peak, the 40 was a deeply entrenched, unhoused community tucked into the blackberry brambles and marshy private property along Samoa Boulevard, where the railroad corridor crosses into the city. It had its own informal social structure, long-term residents who had built pallet-supported shelters and put down roots. Some say that in years past, local police had directed them there as an alternative to camping downtown, where they might be ticketed. Many of those displaced relocated to the nearby former soilscape warehouse that had sat empty at the edge of the railroad corridor and had become a de facto overflow camp through the fall into winter as a neighboring property was cleared by new directions. That option ended on January 21st of this year when a tent fire broke out inside the warehouse. Although the warehouse was not structurally damaged, by noon that day, police were enforcing a trespass warning issued the previous July. One of those long-term residents is a woman named Brandy. She had been living near the corridor for roughly 5 years and had been acting as a caregiver for her neighbor Robin Brooks, an elderly, disabled woman who needs crutches to walk and has been homeless for 20 years. Here, Brandy speaks with Arcata Police Lieutenant Luke Scown along the railroad tracks as he advises remaining residents that they are in violation of a trespass order.
I'm just saying, for my instance, they don't offer me housing. He said he's going to try to get Robin housing. And I mean, that's our main concern. That's my main concern. But yeah, I'm trying to get housing too. And I'm trying to find another job too, so I can get out of here. But when I have to keep moving my encampment, it's kind of hard. I don't have nowhere else to go. So it's hard to make it on time. It's not like I'm a good employee. I work hard. So I've worked my whole life.
Through all of it, Robin Brooks has stayed put. Brooks has a serious mobility impairment from an old injury and needs crutches to walk. Outreach workers considered her case the most sensitive of all the disability situations along the corridor. So, on February 3rd, she submitted a formal written request to the City of Arcata under the Americans with Disabilities Act. She asked for time to prepare, for physical help moving her belongings, for transportation to accessible housing near her services, and for a mental health professional present during any law enforcement actions, as well as protection of her personal property if it would be left behind. In her first on-camera interview, Brooks talked about what her life at camp looks like and what the place means to her as she considered where to go from there.
It feels like home.
It feels like home. And I know in a previous interview you had explained that you lost your husband while you were out here.
Well, he lived out here with me for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years or something like that. And he was having chest pains and he left to go to town. And that's the last time I seen him because he had a heart attack right out there. You know, it was over with before I even heard about it.
Oh, you know? Uh-huh.
So.
So they know you've been up here for how long?
10 years.
Right here, huh?
Yeah. He said, get a few things together and I'll be back. Yeah, I could never just, you know, figure out. I was sitting here trying to think that. What would I just take? And it was like really hard to figure out. That black box over there is Jim. But how could I like leave something like that behind? You know, it's like, I mean, you know, that's the best they can treat me, or that's the best that they treat people.
Was there any offer of, you know, physical assistance to help you relocate or anything?
Nothing. That's 2 days ago. That's it. That's all I've been told. That's it.
Okay. Did Arcata House Partnership send over anybody to talk with you about resources and alternatives?
Yes. Kevin came over, told me to call him if I wanted or needed anything. I think he said, you know, that, you know, they'd go as far as to get me a motel room if they had to or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Shortly after Brooks submitted her ADA request to the city manager, Merritt Perry, the first no trespassing signs appeared nailed to trees near her campsite, the first she said she had ever seen there. Perry acknowledged receiving the request from Brooks, but declined to respond to questions about it, writing only, quote, "We are aware of requests for accommodation from trespassers. However, I have no comment regarding that at this time," unquote. What followed was an Arcata police visit to the corridor where officers, including Lieutenant Scound, delivered written responses to some of the residents' particular ADA requests. But those letters did not address the ADA concerns noted. They simply restated trespass laws and directed people to Arcata House's annex across town. Robin Brooks did not receive one.
It was like maybe one officer came. He didn't come into my tent, but he was like right outside there, and he just said that I was trespassing and get a few things together because he'd be back. And he asked who he was talking to, and I said Robin. And that's about it. Well, I am trespassing. But It just seems like it's okay because so many years went by them knowing that I was here. You know, I'm surprised this popped up.
To understand the city's actual role, we filed a California Public Records Act request. Text messages obtained by Redheaded Black Belt show months of direct communication between city manager Merritt Perry and John Shelter, the owner of the People of New Directions, who is contracted to manage the day-to-day clearing operations on each property, including the railroad. The messages cover scheduling, logistics, and strategy. In one October message, just before work paused for the winter rains, Shelter told Perry, quote, "All of the camps are demolished and in a giant pile that we'll be hauling out," unquote. Perry has formally described the city's role as supportive and responding to property owners' requests for trespassing. However, invoices obtained through the PRA show that the city managed billing between the contractor of New Directions and the Great Redwood Trail Agency, controlling the railroad right-of-way. Messages also reveal documented tension between the city of Arcata and Hatcher, the Humboldt Area Center for Harm Reduction. In one exchange, Shelter sent Perry photos of the Hatcher outreach van on a public street and wrote, quote, "Hatcher van, no wonder there's so many zombies walking around O Street," unquote. Perry's response, per the screenshot, reads, "The property owner should call police and ask for trespassing enforcement," unquote. Hatcher's executive director told Redheaded Black Belt that the enforcement actions had, quote, "created further barriers to care for those in need," unquote. On February 4th, this reporter was on the railroad corridor when Arcata police returned for another trespass enforcement patrol.
No, you can't be on the private property. The property owners don't want anybody on there right now, so you do need to leave the property, please.
All right, I'll get back up there.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The city of Arcata has not adopted the state's 2025 model ordinance on encampment removals. Perry, who became the city manager in August of 2024, simply responded to our inquiry, quote, "We have not brought any new policies to the city since I have been with the city," unquote. City of Arcata has consistently pointed to Arcata House partnership as evidence of its commitment to resources alongside enforcement. Perry confirmed that the city contributed $200,000 for emergency shelter beds at Arcata House. A few short months later, the adult emergency shelter was already at capacity with a waitlist in place. By mid-February, that waitlist had grown to approximately 70 individuals, partly because of federal funding reductions, which had forced staffing cuts, according to Executive Director of Arcata House, Florence Carroll. 11 individuals from the corridor were placed into emergency hotel rooms in mid-February, extended night by night, with no guaranteed time frame. Others who had been directed to Arcata House's annex on 9th Street were ticketed by Arcata police for camping outside the building while waiting for services. For Brandy, the temporary hotel room offered by Arcata House was both a relief and its own kind of uncertainty. After 2 weeks, Brandy's checkout came without explanation and without a backup plan. Like many former Railroad Corridor residents or people from the 40, she returned to the streets. Hatcher's executive director told us, quote, "When people are displaced from encampments, especially by threat of systemic violence, it upends the sources of safety and stability that they have found in their lives. Treating people as if their homes and lives are disposable is dehumanizing, cruel, and perpetuates a cycle of destabilization that only makes it more difficult to find stability again," unquote. Arcata House says it works to ensure individuals with disabilities have equitable access during transitions, coordinating packing, storage, resources, and services. For Brooks, those efforts have been largely driven by mutual aid funding, community volunteers, and a storage unit purchased by activists rather than city-initiated support.
Please be, you know, gentle about it. Let me move, you know, let me relocate. You know, don't just like force me and take my stuff and arrest me and put my dog in the pound. You know, just let me relocate.
Do you have any idea where you would relocate to?
I really don't. Really at a loss with that. I've really been trying to think about it, and I haven't come up with anything in my mind so far. This is probably like, I always thought this was the last good camp spot. I did. I always thought like from here there is no other, you know, place to go. And I thought that for years, because everybody's, they're kicked out of everywhere else, and it's like I just thought I was like resting in this little spot that nobody really, you know, was bothered about it. I know it's not reasonable to really think that way, but maybe, I don't know, maybe, you know, it depends, like, what the landowner says, I guess, you know.
As of last week, Robin Brooks was still at her campsite and had received another visit from Arcata police informing her that she will be asked to leave in coming days. For 9 months, the city of Arcata coordinated the clearing of a 2-decade-old homeless community, managing the billing, directing a private contractor, and continuing law enforcement actions across 4 properties, while the people being displaced had to navigate a local shelter system already at capacity. To see our in-depth full reporting on this matter, go to Redheaded Black Belt. For KMUD News, I'm Ryan Hudson.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments both for and against the imposition of a long-standing federal law that restricts gun rights for those with a history of cannabis use. While in California, there isn't specific law that prohibits marijuana users from owning firearms, it is against federal law to smoke weed and own a gun. The case is United States v. Hamani, and it specifically goes after whether or not federal statute 18 U.S.C. 922G3 violates the Second Amendment as applied to respondents. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, NORML, is one of many advocacy groups that filed amicus briefs in the case asking the court to strike down the categorical ban. Among them was also the National Rifle Association. The legal brief claims, quote, cannabis has been a ubiquitous part of American life since the founding, and there is no historical tradition of disarming its users, end quote. And also points out that modern federal and state policy currently treats cannabis as a legitimate medicine and regulated commodity through state legalization of the substance, which undermines the claim that cannabis is incompatible with responsible gun ownership. I spoke with Joseph Bondi, the chairman for the board of directors of Normal and a co-chair of the Amicus Committee, and David Holland, a partner of New York law firm Holland Shriver LLP and co-chair with Bondi on the Amicus Committee, in an interview about the case and what it can mean for folks in Humboldt County.
The case was argued before the Supreme Court of the United States yesterday. It involves the question of whether the law that makes it a felony for a person who's an illegal drug user to possess a firearm is constitutional, and primarily as applied to cannabis and cannabis users. Mr. Hamani had an ounce or two of cannabis, correct me if I'm wrong, David, in the nightstand. I think his weapon was in the same room. There was no evidence of intoxication. He did make some statements conceding that he used cannabis every other day or a few times a week. Yep.
So tell me a bit about the arguments that were presented yesterday, and how do you feel that went?
David? Well, so I listened to about the first hour and a half of it, and it was an extraordinary argument. I did not think it would run that long because it was only slotted for an hour, and it may have gone longer, and Joe may be able to tell you how long it actually went. But the government's position was that there have been historically laws against drunkenness and people that are suffer from chronic alcoholism and things of that nature, and therefore those folks have been allowed to be disarmed, and that should apply also to cannabis users on the grounds that it is a illegal substance being Schedule 1, and therefore it's an illegal drug, and that's part of what's in the 18 U.S.C. 922 G3 statute, which was at stake. The arguments that being put forward by Hamani was that under the Supreme Court precedent in Bruen, B-R-U-E-N, that there has to be a historical analog to disarm somebody. And those like drunkards and so forth, it really is only during that period of time of actually under the influence of the intoxicant rather than just a complete ban based on their condition, which all can always be improved by the fact if they were to discontinue drinking or not be impaired at the time of the possession of the weapon. And I think that they pushed back very well, and the questions of the justices were directed towards trying to get this historical framework for why cannabis users would be unique as compared to other folks, and when they were having trouble wrapping their head around it, particularly since hemp and the cannabis plant have been ubiquitous in our country's history. And so, and I'm going to let Joe jump in a second, but they, I think there was really great question of shouldn't the disarmament be only for periods of time of impairment, not categories of people, though there have been historically categories of people that have been disarmed for periods of time. Joe, why don't you finish out on that?
Yeah, sure. I love the argument. I listened to it all, and the justices expressed a lot of skepticism, I think. And Gorsuch, you know, started out with the premise that back in the day, in the founding days, 8 shots a day made you an occasional drunkard, right? And then John Adams had cider for breakfast, and then he went into this question of, is one gummy bear every other night enough to disarm you for life, right? And he kind of forced the government to admit that, yes, under their theory, even that counts, right? And that was like, I was like a lollipop for our argument, right? For 922G3. But he like kind of skewered the schedule everything logic, right? And that was really very cool. Then Justice Barrett came out. She came out and she was focused on this notion of dangerousness, right? And talked about like Robitussin and Ambien and Adderall. And this is like just about lawfulness or dangerousness, right? And I think it was really also pretty cool because the government, you know, had to concede that violence wasn't a factor really in the scheduling structure. And I'm like listening to the voices on the audio, right? It was pretty neat to also figure them out. But, and we have a transcript of it also I got yesterday. But Justice Jackson was like kind of was good to have her there, right? And she was talking about this idea that you can't just say something is intoxicating and therefore it's dangerous, and that's history. So I think she was with us too. Sotomayor raised ayahuasca and talked about party users, and what about using away from the gun once a week? And I think she used the phrase a stick of cannabis or something for a chili. It was great, a fucking stick. So we had sticks and gummy bears and ayahuasca in one oral argument, and then Kavanaugh rocked on in, and he was kind of like talking about addiction, right? Addiction is historically disarmable, and that's kind of true, right? Addiction is not what we're talking about with cannabis use, right? We're talking about consumption versus, and then someone had made the point that there's a difference between a habitual drinker and a habitual drunkard, which is what those old laws used to apply to, right? There's a lot of habitual drinkers that are not kind of under the umbrella of the statute. But I kind of thought that it was interesting that Kavanaugh was narrowing the statute to addicts only, right? Is that like a part lollipop? And then Roberts, I was so surprised, right, David? He was discomforted by the notion of drug-by-drug, you know, findings and litigation and turning this question of, you know, whether you're an unlawful user who's habitual or whatever into like multiple mini trials. So I feel like and Alito was wildly, wildly disposed against all of this stuff, right? So I feel like the strong majority of the court expressed a belief consistent with the finding that the statute is unconstitutional in one manner or another, whether it's applied to cannabis users overall, whether it's applied to people who don't show indicia of violence or, you know, intoxication or addiction. I thought it was a really very good day for us and a lot of fun, much more fun to listen to than, you know, a lot of these arguments that you hear.
Absolutely. I'd just add one thing with Roberts, as Joe was talking about, and sort of the discomfort of going drug by drug, but that what that actually lends to and what was sort of embraced by others, like how do you know one drug to another, which is, you know, worse, and is there violence or is there not, leads you down to the road, was there ever science to put this into Schedule One to begin with? It inevitably, all roads lead to, this really may not belong in Schedule One as an illegal drug in the way that others are, and it doesn't lead to the habitual addiction or habitual drunkenness that has been categorically allowed at certain periods of time in our history. So it's fascinating to watch them undo our historical approach to the very issue.
Oh, yeah, and I've never heard of a court case described as fun before. But, but I that's good.
Okay. I've never heard of cannabis sticks cool, before.
One gummy bear away. Gummy bear away from like losing your life.
And so tell me, why do you think this case matters to them? Humboldt, where we're located, is Humboldt County, which is known for marijuana and everything. So why do you believe it's important for them to know this is happening?
Well, here's the thing. This law makes thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands, of your residents felons, right? If you're in possession of a firearm and smoking a doobie on a Tuesday night, right? That's it. Like, you're done. You're history. And, you know, you don't have the same ability to, say, protect your land or your property as other people do. Right? Other farmers may. You don't have the same ability to protect your homestead as other people may. And, of course, I'm making the presumption that there are some people in your neck of the woods that actually smoke the weed, you know? But I think it matters to a lot of people. I think it matters if you're a hunter. I think it matters if you're a casual shooter. I think it matters if you have a gun in your home or in a business, right? Because you may not look at it as you're doing anything wrong. You may not pair your smoking pot with either intoxication or firearm possession, but the government does. And if we can win a victory here, I think that's a victory for all of us. And any day that our rights are being protected and our Constitution being upheld is, frankly, a good day.
And so then I was curious, I saw that the NRA also filed an amicus brief. Are there any other advocacy groups that did, aside from Normal and the NRA?
You should check the docket, right? Check the Supreme Court docket. Yeah.
There were quite a number. The American Civil Liberties Union, there were some other...
NACDL, Gun Owners of America. But check the docket. There are a number of... There's some professors, too. There were a number of amici in the gang.
What are the steps moving forward? Are you guys waiting for the summer, I believe? Or is there anything else that you guys do in the meantime?
That's a great question. as the amicus committee, you know, we evaluate cases that come through, and this was, I think, the third brief we had put in on this issue of 922G3. So as cases come up, Joe and I sort of evaluate and decide whether we want to put something in. But in this particular case, I think now we just wait to see what the decision is.
Yep, and I will say this, though, because Normal is looking for a few things, and please let your constituents know. We're looking for novel cases that we can bring as Amici and that we can add to our voice to the fight, so to speak. We're also looking for people to become plugged in with us. And of course, Normal is the oldest and largest cannabis consumer advocacy group in the world, been around since 1970. So we commend people to the website, to our weekly news. Of course, we ask for donations through our tax-deductible arm or through our 501c3 arm. But David and I are also both practicing attorneys in New York with vibrant practices that we'll be working away at. Cannabis law keeps you busy these days. But there's a lot of fun coming out of this field of law. There's an enormous amount of hope, I think, on the horizon. It's been a pleasure to work with our amicus committee with people from throughout the country, right? From like Lee Berger in Oregon, Nikki Fried and Greg Morris in Florida, Dan Vietz in Missouri, right? It's been really, and Paul Armentano, who of course was very helpful in providing, you know, insight into the science for us. So it's been a wonderful experience. All these briefs that we do are really wonderful team experiences. And I'm looking for the next, as David is. So let people know.
Absolutely. And for those up here who don't really know what Normal is, could you kind of get in a little bit more about what you guys do? You started in the 70s, right?
1970, by our founder, Keith Stroup, spelled S-T-R-O-U-P. We are the largest and oldest cannabis consumer advocacy group in the world. We have 36 affiliate chapters in the United States, chapters abroad. And our mission statement is to ensure access to safe, pure, not overtaxed cannabis for all, right? And of course, we have a number of committees. We have a national legal committee. We have several hundred lawyers from throughout the country who've, you know, pledged their support to us for life. People in California, Omar Figueroa is on our national legal example. Eric Shevin, Bruce Margolin, who runs California Normal with Dale Geringer. So when you start to think about the history of cannabis legalization in America, it was really Normal that was foundational in that movement. And we all have an enormous debt of gratitude that we owe to Keith Stroup. So David and I have been involved in New York as lawyers for decades. And David, do you want to add to your experiences with Normal?
Yeah, no, it's been, a game-changing event that I really started through my working in the legal department of High Times magazine, and the relationship between High Times and Normal was one since the beginning. And I'm now the head of New York State's, or what we call Empire State Normal, and I'm the executive and legal director of that. And the challenges and the exciting changes that the advocacy of the Normal organizations and all of its affiliates have brought about, you know, there was no such thing as conversations about legalizing it back when we started, and look where we've come. So we're in front of the United States Supreme Court talking about maybe it's time to change the law because people who smoke cannabis are not necessarily bad people.
It's extraordinarily, extraordinarily powerful work, you know, and David and I both, our anchor is as criminal defense attorneys saving people from jails, right, for 30 years each. And been marvelous to put ourselves out of business in the federal cannabis realm and in New York as well, for what it's worth. We have lots of other criminal work going on, as you can imagine, but it's been particularly satisfying to not have federal or state cannabis defendants anymore.
A decision by the court is expected this summer. To access the legal brief for this case and learn more, the website is norml.org on their brief bank page. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporter, Ryan Hudson. KMO News is online, and you can find us on KMO.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.